Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
If you happen to have 2.5 minutes to spare today, you could do worse than watching back the closing stages of the first half of the England-France game from Saturday. I've just done it myself, and let me tell you, it'll put a smile on your face. Hi, Murph.
Hey, Owen, how's it going?
Hi, Ken, it's going all right. How are you?
Owen, very well. How are you?
Welcome, everyone, to Monday Second Captain's Podcast. This could be the greatest passage of play that didn't result in a score that I've ever seen in the Six Nations. So just under 2.5 minutes on the clock. Left to go, that is, in the first half. England kick an aimless ball to just outside the French 22. Mathieu Jalibert casually controls it on the volley, watches it bounce around a little bit, scoops it up, puts the step on two England players. Now, we're not talking Tadhg Furlong level of sidestep here, Murph. Not quite that class. But did step the players nonetheless. Glides past a couple more defenders before offloading. The French get turned over. England try another kick. This one is heading into touch before Teddy Thomas decides to keep it in play, prompting Alan Quinlan and commentary to shout, "What is he doing?" Before Thomas then burns past Anthony Watson on the outside and sets up a move that almost results in one of the all-time great Twickenham tries. Passes everywhere, offloads, DuPont involved regularly. Even after England turned that one over, they knock it on themselves around halfway. The French hooker, Julien Marchand, thinks, what'll I do here? Yeah, I'll set up another counter-attack. This time, the French try a little chip through. George Ford collects it, boots it into touch, and the players trudge off the field as if they've just played two full games of rugby back-to-back without a break, not just one half of rugby. The only pity is there wasn't a try scored at the end of it, but not for the want of attacking intent on the French side anyway. Unbelievable.
It was ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. And you know, you mentioned the sort of fatigue that the players appeared to be operating under as they trudged off. I mean, there was an element of the second half being like, okay, these guys have actually just ran themselves into the ground in the first 40 minutes. But I mean, was that like the best half of rugby ever played? I mean, funnily enough, right? You know, New Zealand France in 2007 is often held up.
I was going to say, like, you know, yeah, France are often involved. Yeah, France are often involved when they do the top five of these things. Yeah,
I watched a good 50 minutes of that on Air. You know, Air were showing it again not that long ago. Terrible, so bad, a really boring game. I mean, Wayne Barrett's screwing over all of New Zealand is funny, yes, but it doesn't necessarily make for a brilliant rugby match. I mean, that half on Saturday was just, I can't remember a better half of rugby ever. Like, it was just insanely, insanely good. And then Ireland-Scotland yesterday was even better, even more dramatic. Well, maybe
I think not. It had drama in it. I think the France New Zealand 99 game actually goes down, doesn't it? Is that not the one that goes down as an absolute classic? But anyway, I do want to ask you, if I want to put you in this situation, if you're Mathieu Jalibert versus Tadhg Furlong, if you're the isolated defender in midfield and you have to defend one of those two, who are you more frightened of?
Well, am I my own size? Or have I inhabited
you're
the
Murph.
Body?
No, you're Murph.
I'll take Mathieu Jalibert, because I mean, he'll just run around me and that's fine. I mean, Tadhg could sidestep me, but he could also inflict like severe physical pain on me as well.
He would sidestep you though. I mean, and that would be the... Well, then you have the feeling, I've been sidestepped by a bloody prop.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the Scottish defenders.
If I could say to Tadhg, if I could outline the rules of engagement, it's like, you have to try inside, you can't just run over me, then I'd rather it be Tadhg Furlong. But just the chance that Tadhg could be like, I could go around this guy, but why waste the energy? this guy, you know, he's a beanpole. I can just step right through this guy, crack a couple of his ribs, and not even feel it. Like, this guy's a speed bump.
Notice. Yeah, you may as well not be there.
Yeah.
It's fair to say the Scotland-Ireland game was a little stodgy by comparison, but it did contain some drama, Murph requiring Johnny Sexton to rescue the win with a kick that he himself said wasn't well struck, but still found a way in over the posts from near the left touchline. Shane Horgan was one of the few people in Murrayfield to see it, and he's on the show today with Andrew Trimble. But first, it's Hogglebox.
You know, I had a huge amount of belief within the boys to come down here and win.
Stuart Hogg turns up to a fucking winning the bloody World Cup. I love it.
Stuart Hogg.
I believed in the boys' ability.
Man of the match.
Scotland are a disgrace to World Cup. Hogwatch on, Hogglebox. Either way, the question remains, how did our man go? Well, there was a blinding spell at out half, an immaculately kicked conversion, but I'm sure a nagging feeling afterwards that, well, how would Stuart put this? That maybe this was a Six Nations campaign for Scotland that flattered to deceive somewhat. I mean, I find it hard to get past that particular phrase. Listen, there are a lot of positives to take, as Stuart no doubt would say. And they'll probably beat France away in their last game, so there's always that. But will the 2021 Six Nations go down as a possible opportunity missed, Stuart?
What a stumble from the captain!
What do you reckon? Was it a slightly inconsistent campaign? Or here's a more pertinent question, maybe. Will you ever learn? Play the fucking bed.
You know, I had a huge amount of belief within the boys to come down here and win.
Stuart Hogg turns up to a winning the bloody World Cup. I love it.
Stuart Hogg.
I believed in the boys' ability.
Man of the match.
Scotland are a disgrace to World Cup.
Yeah, Scotland. High hopes. Bullishness. One big win. Followed by defeats.
Like, they're definitely beating France as well. Two away wins against England and France. Two home defeats. Wales and Ireland.
I was quite impressed with how Hoggy stepped into out half.
Oh,
I mean, thought he was actually better than Finn Russell.
He is such an unbelievably good rugby player. Honestly, it is quite crazy. And I feel bad, you know, abusing him like this. He's merely the face of the Scotland rugby team. It's really not even abuse directed directly at Stuart so much as, you know, his entire, you know, panel management and indeed country.
We're talking Six Nations.
Back to Campbell, back to Duggan, McLaughlin going for that line, and Ireland are in and over.
What do you reckon, Simon? France, England, England, France, I should say, one of the great games, or at least one of the great halves of international rugby of all time.
Yeah, I think the first 40 minutes might have been the highest quality 40 minutes in Six Nations or Five Nations history. The whole thing felt a bit like, remember the Saint-André try in 91, was it? In Twickenham,
yep.
The try from the end of the earth where they, you know, Blanco and Sella. The whole thing was that, and yet England defiant and come up. England were sort of like the tide. They just sort of kept coming slowly and inexorably, and France would like do amazing things, and then but England would go, yeah, that's fine, but we'll still keep coming. Like, England's response to that opening try from France was also one of the great sort of psychological responses from a team that have lost, you know, to Scotland and Wales or on a real low. For them to sort of pull out that confidence and that type of rugby from there was amazing as well. But I loved it from start to finish. I thought the second half was as gripping, just not as high quality, and maybe the defences came into it more, so it maybe didn't seem quite as exciting, but I thought it was as captivating. And then, I don't know, I think France might think afterwards, can we actually play as well as that again? I mean, can France play any better than that? Because they were brilliant in defence as well, brilliant set piece, brilliant at rooks and mauls, and they still lost the game.
This might be a stupid question. In the words of Brian Clough, I might be a bit stupid about this sort of thing, but why can't our games be a bit more like that, Si?
Good question, Owen. The entire country was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, and you know, after the England-France game, we're going, oh God, we're going to watch Ireland-Scotland and feel so inadequate. And the England-France game felt to me like a beautiful vision of the future. If you were to, you know, make a video game of what rugby should be in 5 or 10 years' time, because there was very few, you know, concussions, very few stoppages, reset scrums, refs taking forever to make up their mind. It wasn't even a dirty game. It was just, you know, clean, both teams playing with such ambition. And then you wonder, is that talent? But it's definitely intent as well. you know, Eddie Jones, even when England are playing terrible, you sort of feel Eddie Jones has a plan, something in the oven that he can pull out at any stage. And the quality of coaching for both those two sides. And we've spent basically forever wondering, would England and France both realize what they have, you know, what sort of talent they have? And it seems like finally both at the same time have realized it. And the other nations and the Six Nations could be in for a bad time for the next while. But no, I think the hardest thing to fix in rugby, we're always talking about like set piece and defense and all those other bits and line out. They're all the easier bits. The hardest bit is getting that sort of flowing attacking rugby going phase after phase.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not...
I don't see a quick fix is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I'm not talking about necessarily playing it. Like, I don't know if we're necessarily, if we have the ability to play at the level of France or England. But I mean, you're in a situation where you're 14 points up against a horribly underperforming Scotland team at Murrayfield. You're dominating every facet of the game, especially the set piece. Mm. And yet, rather than drive it home and play some nice stuff, you somehow allow them back in. I guess that's my point. Like, we had a platform to actually show a bit of stuff in the last 20 minutes yesterday, and instead we seemed to go into our shells.
Yeah, I did think of 14 points up, it would be the first time the coaches and players could relax. For the first time in 2.5 years, we relax and go, well, let's try out some stuff here. Let's really go to town and take some genuine momentum into the England game. And you know, though, sometimes the last 15, 20 minutes of those games, you run in 2 or 3 tries and you sort of win by 25, 30 points and you feel great going into the England game. I felt we robbed all that and it just became this frantic, nervous end game. And actually, we were brilliant. Our response to going 24 all was really good. We did literally everything right. The kickoff, the pressure on Ali Price, the chase, we didn't give away a penalty, and then the ruck turnover, and then the penalty, and even then our management of the last couple of minutes of Scotland. So sort of 75 minutes to 80, 81 minutes was absolutely brilliant, but it still felt like we'd robbed ourselves of an attacking performance. You know, it was, we were a moments team again, you know, loads of little moments like stealing lineouts and, you know, those things, but the flow was robbed. We never, ever got the flow going.
Shane was at Murrayfield to see Ireland squeak home in the end. How are things, Shane?
Not too bad. They good, did it good, to me good. Again, lads, didn't they?
Yeah.
Last minute tipping of Scotland before the game and slapped me in the face again.
I saw that. I saw you committed to Scotland just right at the end before the match. Yeah, you committed fully to Scotland.
No, you tried to sit in the fence with the prediction.
I did a little, but I said ultimately I thought Scotland couldn't play as bad as they did, but they've proved me wrong yet again. And that, this is it now. I'm out. I'm out of the Scottish game. I'm out of them. I'm out of tipping them from here on in. Something drastic is going to happen for me ever to have to tip these mob again.
These mob, yeah. That's the kindest way you could put it. And Andrew Trimble was watching at home, presumably singing along to your favourite anthem in world rugby, the Flower of Scotland. Andrew, that won't make sense to the non-members listening. But
No. I stayed very much supporting Ireland all Sunday afternoon, and it was a big build up after the England France game, and everybody was looking forward. It could have potentially been the big game of the weekend, and it wasn't. The whole game was a big disappointment. But anyway, we'll get into that.
Yeah, we'll get into that. If we start on a positive note, Shane Sexton's kick, his nerveless kick at the end. He said afterwards that he didn't strike it as well as he struck his other kicks on the day. It did look on TV like it was going wide, and then it drifted in. And he also mentioned that there was a bit of a wind that obviously we can't pick up watching at home. How difficult was the kick from where you were sitting?
It was quite difficult for me to even see the angle, because I was almost not quite in line with the posts. But it did look like a tricky one. The conditions were... they weren't too bad. There was definitely a bit of a wind, but always in Murrayfield, at ground level, the wind isn't that noticeable. But once you kick the ball any bit into the air at all, you can notice it's pretty swirly. And then the other thing, the footing wasn't great. There was a thin film of rain or drizzle that had come down from about 2 o'clock till about 2:30, so things were slightly slippy as well, and it felt quite muggy for the entire game. So it was certainly a good kick. I didn't anticipate him not kicking it, but I was surprised. I'm always surprised that some of the kicks that Sexton turns down, actually. So the penalty opportunity in the first half where he went to the corner, I think he should have kicked the points there, certainly. And actually, I know they ultimately got a try from it, but the points in the second half where they kicked to the corner, I too would have gone for the post under those circumstances. So, and I don't know if that is strategy or is it that sometimes Sexton doesn't fancy those kicks. He had no option but to kick this kick, and he did, and that's why he should you know, more confidence in kicking the others.
I find that mechanism over decision making, whether to go to the corner or take 3 points, I find that really interesting, and it worked perfectly in the past because it was Rory was captain and Johnny was 10, so you've got your line out representative and your kicking representative, and they have that kind of playoff. But Rory ultimately makes the decision, you suppose, and he only asks Johnny whenever he thinks that he wants that, he's kind of favoring that way. So it was a strange one because Johnny then turns to James Ryan and says, "What do you want?" James Ryan isn't going to turn around and say, no, don't give us a line out down there. He's always going to back himself. So you're going to get a complete skewed view of what he thinks is the right decision.
Yeah.
Ronan spoke about this on Virgin, I think it was last year, that there is always a doubt in a kicker's mind that they're not completely bulletproof. You know, very often they want to kick, but sometimes they don't. And sometimes in the most, you know, trying circumstances, they don't. And, you know, he said he played with captains, whether it be Mick Galloway or Paul O'Connell, he would just go, kick it. You're kicking it. There's no option. There's no discussion. Now, Sexton has to have that discussion with himself almost. Say, you know, is this a kick? Do I want the kick? Is there something about me that allows me a get out? And he can always give himself a bit of a get out. Now, the good thing was, when he didn't have the kick get out, he delivered it, and that was most important.
But the get out, as you call it, Shane, is a legitimate one, because he, you know, you're framing it that he's not confident enough that he's going to kick 3 points in those situations, but he would frame it that he thinks they can score 7 or at least 5.
No, and that's, there is a legitimacy in that, and I think that's when you have another player making that decision, that takes any of those, you know, micro doubts that you may have out of it. So it's very hard to have very clear thinking under those circumstances, because, you know, Ronan has said, you know, I thought the most bulletproof kicker of all time, that there was times where he didn't really want to kick and he was quite happy for it to go to the corner. Now, what is influencing Johnny in those circumstances? Listen, I'm sure he'll say it was entirely because he felt it was the right opportunity in both those to go to the corner, and to, because they were going to score 7. And one of those times it worked out. So, you know, what do I know? I just think I would, under those, both those circumstances, I would have kicked goals.
Do you think he might have saved his coach's job by kicking the 3 points?
I don't think we'd be sitting here speaking about Andy Farrell being sacked. I don't think that would happen. I think the pressure would be ramping up, and whatever goes on in the England game this week would be, you know, certainly even more relevant, and it would be a pretty disastrous Six Nations given the results so far and the lack of meaningful progress as well. So unless there was something
to be that dominant over Scotland, for your forts to obliterate the opposition, to be 14 points up and to have lost obviously to Wales and France so far, and, you know, really patchy last year as well, I think, I don't know. And then if you lose that game or you draw against Scotland, you're very unlikely to win the England game anyway. I just think Sexton might just have given his coach certainly another year. You don't know. Like, these things, you can never sort of quantify these things exactly. But it sort of felt to me like, Janey, if he misses this and we draw, the whole narrative around Farrell changes.
I agree with Shaggy. I don't think we'd be talking about Farrell getting sacked. I think potentially Johnny might just have earned forgiveness for shaking his head in Paris at Farrell taking him off. I think he's definitely saved Farrell getting a little bit more of a hard time than he would have, but he's still very accountable for being in a great position to put Scotland to bed, just completely put the game out of sight, being 14 points up. How many times in the past have we seen Ireland go that far ahead against Scotland and then just kick on and scored a couple more tries before the end, and then the game's just that you wondered what the fuss was about. And that's the way I thought it was going to go. And again, whatever happened, I think Johnny definitely saved his blushes and saved him getting a hard time. I don't think he saved his job.
Shane, do you mind if we touch on a few things that I think are going really well for us? Sort of the energy and desire is really noticeable in the team. There's a sort of passion about us. And, you know, that isn't always the case, but it's extra noticeable at the moment. The likes of Henderson, who I thought was brilliant, who maybe should be captain. Maybe that's something we'll discuss another day. Henshaw, obviously, CJ Stander. We're really well drilled pack now. Like, our basics in our pack are really, really good. And that almost puts the contrast with our lack of direction in attack more in focus, and the unreliable defence as well. It's almost like the better our line out and our rooking and our mauling and our, you know, defensive displays at rook time become, the more you go, Gene, if Paul O'Connell has done that in that space of time, what are Mike Catt and Easterby doing in the same space of time, or actually more time in the Ireland setup?
Yeah, you did feel that there was quite a lot of low quality play to what Ireland were doing, mixed with some really high quality stuff. So I laboured the point yesterday on TV when Andy Farrell did an interview, and he spoke about, you know, number one thing being intent. And it's quite a hard thing to quantify what you mean by that. And I assume what he means by it is being very aggressive, you know, running very hard, you know, cleaning out rooks, you know, very efficiently, and getting consistently over the gain line. And I suppose on the defensive side, making all your getting off the line and making your tackles. And they did that. They started with a great intent, if that's to be a measure of what intent is. They got over the gain line. Players were running with ambition. I thought we did get a little bit, when we got into the 22, we still got a little bit too focused around the ruck and a bit too one-out runnery. But generally, it paid off for us. Around the breakdown, we were consistently very good, I thought, and they couldn't control the breakdown at all, and that makes things very difficult for them to get going, and that was the case. And then the line-out was extraordinarily good. The defensive line-out was, I don't know, potentially if Ireland's line-out has ever been better than that. We just had them in complete disarray. And if you take out one of the key platforms for any team as a starter play, then it's very, very difficult to win, and almost impossible to win under those circumstances. So those things were, you know, look good. Now the intent fell away a little bit, because it does fall away. It's impossible to keep that veracity up for the entire 80 minutes. So what should you be doing? So what you should be doing is having a little bit of a cooler head and moving the ball to the areas where yards will be gained easier. And at no time did we really do that.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the biggest problem is. I think the biggest problem is our defence. But closely behind that is our ability to get the ball into space and be really threatening in those wide channels. And as you say, Simon, it's put into sharp focus, because we've got no excuse now. Our breakdown's so good, our set piece is so good. And but to tackle the defence thing, first of all, I just think we look soft. I just think we concede really soft, easy tries against Wales. Not so much against France, but yeah, there at the weekend again, we make the turnover off CJ. Urzi should take a forward on in front of him. He doesn't. Ringrose, you know, it was a little bit aimless, or it was just inaccurate. And I don't think we saw the best of Ringrose. I thought that's probably one of his poorer performances. It's such a shame, because he's so capable and we know how good he is, but he definitely didn't look himself at all. But anyway, the try ended up, you know, Hogg, it pings off his face, it bounces a couple of times, then Finn Russell volleys it, and it just pops up in his hand. It looked soft, it looked easy. And then the missed tackle for James Lowe when Hugh Jones came on, and the impact he made. I thought James Lowe just looked really quite sluggish. He just, you know, slow to kind of get his feet correct. And just defensively, I just think we concede really easily. We could defend for long periods of time, but then we just a lapse in concentration or a lapse in, you know, technique. Just James Lowe didn't get his feet right, and we whatever happens one way or another, we just concede tries way too easily. And that means that whenever we should be putting Scotland out of sight, then they get another foothold in the game, and then teams just feel like we're never that far away.
Trims, just on that, I'm kind of less concerned about those two tries as I am more generally about the way Ireland defends. So that first one was a bit of Keystone Kop stuff. It's not a defensive system really that's broken down. It's poor decisions with some good fortune, and actually probably a lack of desire to get back and react.
Sorry, I'll let you make your bigger point, Shane. Just again, interesting to you being there. Alan Quinlan said that James Lowe was very slow for that one as well.
I think he was worried about overrunning the ball there.
Yeah, I felt a little bit sorry for him. That the ball came really fast, and I know I was listening to Alan as well, and he said, "Oh, he should have really caught that."
He should have been there sooner. Basically, he was a bit slow in getting over to the position.
I don't think that was really the issue. You know, it was it was more, you know, the poor decision made in the first instance. I don't think, though, generally our scramble is as good as it should be, and actually, I don't think James's scramble is as good as it should be. Would Wales have given up that try? I'm not sure if they would. I think they may, you know, they would have stopped you. And then, you know, more recently, would France have given up that try? Because I think you can see real traits in France that Wales have as well in their scramble defence now because of Sean Edwards. So I'm not sure. We are giving up those tries. Okay, put that aside, though.
Yep.
And that's not an insignificant thing that has to be addressed, but put it aside. Then James Lowe's missed tackle for that try. That was a one-on-one missed tackle that he has to make, and anyone should make. And there's no defensive system in the world that will allow for a mistake of that magnitude, I don't think. Now, again, we didn't cover ourselves with glory afterwards because our scramble, I didn't think it was good. And I thought in particular, Jemson Gibson Park, you know, should have made a better effort. He was, you know, very easily stepped, gave a very soft shoulder the inside, and that was taken. So those two things are, you know, individual errors or decision making errors that should have been rectified. I think generally we're too soft in our defence anyway, compared to the best teams. We're not aggressive enough on the outside. We give too much space on the outside. We go soft and people take it. If you look at how Scotland played in the final quarter, they get to our edges very, very comfortably. Very easily, because something that even Ringrose let us down on. Ringrose is very good at reading in behind who the ball is going to and making the read off that and getting in behind. And I haven't seen this that much of late. I don't think our wingers are making good decisions, Trims. I'd love to hear from you what you think on it. I don't think they're being aggressive enough. And when they're coming in, I think they're half coming in or getting in really bad body position. And if you look at, you know, one of the... I think it was either from a scrum deep in Irish territory in the last 15 minutes. When Scotland really need to get down and score that try, they made 50, 60 metres just from the most basic ever feed the ball out to the backs and just run the arc. And there you go. There's 60 metres for you. Can't do that. Now, it's a very good attacking position to actually go after the opposition. That we never do. We never go after the opposition, and I'd love to see us do that.
You're in your own 22.
In your own 22. Yeah, like, yeah. It's the best.
You've got the numbers.
It's the best. It's the best defensive position. You know, all of a sudden we think that the best position to do our moves is, you know, just slightly outside the 22, and we don't do anything before that, and then after that, it's all, you know, one out round the corner, which is really kind of depressing. But even with that being a bull, we shouldn't be giving up that much space. And I don't know any other team, you know, top team in the world that would give up that much space that easily. So I think we're making individual errors, but we don't have a defensive system where I can see that it's not leading in its class at all. And I think we've seen the difference that a very effective defensive system can mean to a team in a very short period of time. And France is the example of it.
Yeah, I think we look a little bit like almost like we're trying to be too neat and tidy in defence. We're just trying to make sure everybody's numbered up, everybody's got into a perfect position, and then we can execute and then close the gate. And sometimes, like whenever you look at the best defensive systems out there, like France at the minute are just incredible. They take risks and they surprise the attack. And I just don't think, as you say, we don't see wingers like making reads. I'm always reluctant to blame wingers because I know the wingers always get the blame. And I hate that because sometimes it comes whenever you get more width from your forwards, you get your 10, 12, 13 wider, you get Ringrose making good reads, and then you can make reads off the back of that. And then even on the other side, I don't know. I Hugo certainly seems to be maturing nicely, seems to know his way around the rugby pitch, understands that backfield mechanism. But I don't know what he's telling the wingers. I know how important it is as a winger for the fullback just to be telling you, okay, just number up, get ready to go, I'm going to close the gate here, go make a read. That is so reassuring as a winger. And I'm inclined to think, I don't know about James Earls, James Lowe, James Earls. I don't know about James Lowe, but I think Earlsy would be the type of fella who wants to make those reads. And if he was getting that communication from behind him, he would be going for them. So that's the system. And I think you're right. That was the perfect example of Scotland attacking from their 22 and just casually, like it was nothing, put it through the hands and we will make easy yards. It's only a luxury to attack in that part of the pitch when teams defend like Ireland, when no one surprises you. They do the same thing every time and it's passive and it's neat and it's tidy and it looks well, but you're just conceding loads of yards. I don't think the Keystone Cops thing can be just put to one side. I think they enhance each other. I think if you've got a good system, you've got good individual tacklers and defenders who make good decisions. And I think if we had one or two of those, then you can probably say, right, that's okay, we'll go okay here. But we've had four or five tries now, we've conceded really easily and really sloppily.
Trims, how you've played with Earlsy? I think maybe once I played with him, but how noisy is he? I'm wondering how noisy that back three are, and I think it's an issue. And I actually think how noisy is Ringrose, because you'll remember this, making those reads as a winger. It can either feel like you're hanging yourself out to dry because you've made this read, and if I've made a wrong read, that it's definitely the team of, it's going to cost the team a try. So you're anxious about making it, and you don't make them as often. But if you've got a 13 that you're used to working with, you know you'll make a read, and instead they will react. And Dricko is the perfect example of it, and I hate to use Dricko because he was so good, but I made so many reads where Dricka would know I'm making the read and he's in behind me. So he's covering if that ball does get out, or if it goes behind the back, or if I missed the tackle somewhat, he's got me covered. So all of a sudden I go, actually, I am making a read here, but it doesn't mean I'm going to cost the team a try and possibly the match if I don't get it 100% right, because there's a reaction to the read as well.
I absolutely agree. And I think it works both ways. I think if I don't like the idea of the winger always being the one to take the risk, because like, why should I be taking the risk? We're all trying to defend here together. So whenever you've got someone like Ringrose, usually does this so well. Dricko, obviously. Darren Cave always did it very well for Ulster. But if you've got a 13 who can shoot and read slightly more in to out, shoot and try and get someone man and ball, if they don't get him, it's okay, because we can save him on the outside. And likewise, if we can make a read, if we get it wrong, we've got Dricko, Cavey, Ringrose coming round and kind of saving us. And I think that's the beauty of a 13 winger combination, but also, as I said, they're the winger and the fullback, having someone who knows you, who appreciates kind of what you see and what you want to read and how you want to defend, just complementing each other. I think, I don't know how chatty Ringrose would be. I don't know. I just know he's a quiet fella on the pitch. I don't know, but I think he usually does defend very well. He's usually pretty, he puts himself under pressure, makes good reads, takes risks. We just didn't see it at the weekend.
That inability to communicate, I don't know if that also translates into their attacking play, Andrew, because it seems like at times, you know, it looks as though, have these lads been training together all week? It looks like two of them are running moves that are different to each other. Balls are being thrown into touch. I mean, not every player or anything, but more than really is acceptable at this level.
Yeah, and I wonder, they seem like they're two distinct things, your attack and your defence, but I do think your attack gets energy from when your defense is really tight and you're getting, I just think energy in general just kind of is contagious. Everything becomes more accurate and there's more of an impact from everything. Whenever your defense is good, it's a great foundation to build a lot of energy through your team. And whether that be communication and attack, there's definitely a little bit of a disconnect, and it's a real shame to see it. And I don't really know what that's down to.
On that, I think this is a real issue that bleeds into attack as well, because the orientation of how the game plan is, who leads the game plan, I think is off at the moment in Ireland. So I think we're too focused forwards, we're too focused from 10 in and not 10 out. And I think it has to be something about the personalities of the players as well. I think, you know, the fact that Johnny has been there for so long and he has traditionally been the fulcrum that everything's been around, along with Conor Murray, and they've been so dictatorial, and it's been useful, but they have been, and that's been what Joe wanted. It's almost left those other players to be more passive or not to be demanding enough about the whole style of play, not just that they're not getting enough ball. You had a situation with either Ireland or Ulster where you had Tommy and Trims on the wings. Do you not think they're screaming for the ball and in training making sure that what they're doing and make sure that they are getting the ball comes out to them, and it, you know, wing play and the wide channels is something that we're going after? You know, I played in the back line with Dennis Hickey and myself, both screaming for balls on the outside. Brian O'Driscoll, you know, what are we going to do? We're keeping the ball in the opposition 22 entirely in pick and goes? Absolutely not. We are an option out here and we want the ball as well. And I just don't feel there's that demand from the outside backs and everyone outside 10 really to get the balance between forward and back play right, and actually then to move the ball beyond the, you know, the 10 loop play really out, just more, you know, more effectively and more simply by passing the ball at the right depth to another back and moving it out to the widest channel.
What were the specific incidents you were thinking of there, Si?
Well, I'm talking about the sort of composure and relationship with each other. Say 5 minutes in, Ringrose eats up the space for James Lowe, who had a bad game but wasn't given a chance by those inside him either, I think. Eats up the space, then passes to Lowe, who gets pushed into touch. There was no, I don't see what the plan was there. I don't know what Ringrose was thinking. It looked like a set play off a scrum, but who knows how it ended up. 12 minutes in, Henshaw to Ringrose like a simple scissors, and they were both sort of hesitant, and then the ball was dropped. A few minutes later, Sexton and Keenan, a really promising attack going into the Scottish 22. They kind of got their wires crossed, and then there was another drop ball. It sort of feels like they don't know what the other is doing. I don't know if that's communication, but it's almost like the relationship between them is broken down. It might be that thing where they're caught between, you know, playing heads up rugby and being told what to do. I don't know, but it just looks like the backs, they, do you know what it looks like to me? They need like somebody to come in and tell them what to do for the next few weeks, like a Graham Henry consultancy role or something like that, like a whole new voice in there to give them some clarity.
It's very strange. It's very unusual to see it. And again, maybe just from the previous regime where there was so much detail that they knew intimately what they were supposed to do when they get the ball in their hands. And maybe now just having a little bit too much freedom, maybe that's now we're paying the price, because you get that much freedom and then guys are thinking different things and there's not enough structure to have the assurance that we're both on the same page. The Ringrose to James Lowe one is very odd. Anybody who watches James Lowe play one game, you'll know what he wants to do when he gets the ball in his hand. He likes to take defenders on, he likes to go on the outside, likes to get the ball in his hands early, and he's so threatening when he does that. And as you say, Simon, he's probably been let down by his teammates a little bit. He didn't play well, but he probably didn't have that much of a chance to play well defensively. Obviously, he's got to take some accountability for that, but Ringrose should know that about him. Having said that, you know, he probably needs to read, not be so one-dimensional and kind of read what Ringrose is doing. He's obviously looking for him to come underneath him. But yeah, there's just a bit of a disconnect, and I wonder, is it too loose? Are they expecting guys to know what each other's doing whenever there's maybe not enough detail around the game plan?
I think this is kind of interesting. Where did this come from? And is it an unforeseen effect of the Joe Schmidt years? And that because we were so structured and that filtered down, if you look at, you know, Joe Schmidt influenced not just the teams that he's played with, but the coaches and the thinking and the academies, and everybody wanted to be Joe Schmidt for so many years and wanted to play the way he did. And that meant a huge amount of responsibility on the coach and getting your message across to the players. But it didn't mean a whole lot of players, you know, thinking for themselves or reacting to their teammates' body language or reacting off the cuff. So what I feel is, if we're maybe falling in between two stools here, where we've got a hangover from the Joe Schmidt, we have players that grew up in the Joe Schmidt system, shall we say, that aren't equipped to do the type or to play the type of rugby that we're potentially looking, or Andy Farrell's potentially looking, or Mike Catt is looking for the players to play. So, you know, what do you do? Do you revert to that more structured play? I don't think that's a great idea. Or do you have to really change how players are being coached at the moment and right the way through the system to ensure that they're more comfortable with making decisions? Because I do think that overly structured style is dead. And we're you know, I do think Schmidt would have evolved it if he was still there. I don't think we'd be doing exactly what Joe Schmidt was doing really effectively, you know, 4 years ago.
Mm. I mean, Rog was saying that in Virgin Media, you know, to change our style radically, Sexton at this stage of his career, is realistically can't change, won't change. And then you see Carberry for Munster at the weekend, and you, that feels like a different style of play. I don't know if he'd come in for the England game. Probably not. I'd nearly prefer if he didn't and just made sure he was absolutely right with Munster first. But it just sort of feels like things can't really change. You know, like I feel like Ringrose has regressed. And I don't know if it's the coaching or what it is, but I would have thought that's the most worrying thing about our attack. If that Ringrose has regressed and his vision isn't up to snuff, then he was the main guy I had my hopes pinned on for Ireland changing as a team. And if he's not doing it, then we're really in trouble.
Yeah, because he's the second receiver we've talked about. He's the guy who's going to have that, you know, two first five eight, second five eight. You know, he's the guy who's going to be able to add a little bit of another dimension. And Henshaw's doing what he's doing so well that I don't think you can ever. I don't think certainly not at the minute. He's probably our best back, and Ringrose is the guy that we go to then for that other addition, you know, a little bit of creativity. And if he's not doing it, then it has such an impact on our whole structure and our whole kind of the options that we have to play with. But yeah, it's a real shame to see him struggle at the minute, and it would be. It doesn't look good for Farrell and that that environment, the fact that he's just not thriving.
We don't have many passers in the back line, though.
Our passing is terrible.
And I'm not just talking about, you know, bad in terms of where we're delivering it, but actually our depth and our depth alignment is what's killing us in many cases. And that's not just from the passer, but it's where the passee, it's where the person who's taking it, they don't seem to be able to get their depth correct. And it means that we struggle more than any team to get to those edges. And if you saw how easily Scotland got to our edges, but how difficult we found it and how lateral we got in our passing, it's really not good. But if you do look at across the back line, who are the really effective passers? Our wingers aren't effective passers. James Lowe is an offloader. He's not a passer. Earlsey is not a passer. And I'm not saying, yes, they're on the end of stuff, but they also are coming round from the blind side to the open. So they're very often link players, or, you know, they can be first or second receivers, but they're not. We haven't had a full back who's been a passer for, you know, a couple of generations, really. You know, it's never been part of our makeup.
Jordan Murphy.
I think that would really change. Yeah, Jordan is the last one that would pass. I don't see either of our centres as really, you know, effective passers. They can pass, but again, I don't think they get the alignment of their pass necessarily always right, or they challenge the defensive line before they pass. So that makes getting to the edges much more difficult, and it makes everything that we're doing look passive and easily defendable.
We did win the game, I should just mention. I don't know how grim this conversation would be getting if we'd actually lost or been held to a draw, as Simon says at the end there. I do want to ask about, I suppose in one way it's hard to look at England-France, Andrew, not through the prism of Ireland. You know, you're looking at those teams and thinking, can we ever play a little bit like that? But I was saying earlier in the show, I rewatched the last couple of minutes of the first half, last 2.5 minutes, and there were no scores in it. And yet even then, the play, it was unbelievable. It had the Jalabert step in midfield after kind of controlling the ball in the volley. It had Teddy Tomac keeping a ball in play when the obvious thing was to let France have their own line out. It had the hooker even trying to start a counter-attack after England spilled the ball at the end. Like, unbelievable stuff. How much did you enjoy that game of rugby?
Yeah, very much so. And as much as we're in outrage mode, Owen, like, just even though we got the win, still feels like we're in outrage. But again, we're probably viewing that through the prism of how good that was on Saturday. It's one of the best games I've watched. It was just incredible. It was amazing to watch. And yeah, it was just an absolute spectacle. Any youngsters considering getting into rugby, whatever you do, parents, don't let your kids watch the Scotland-Ireland game, watch the England-France game, because that's the way rugby should be played. And just it had everything. It had physicality. It was a proper test match, but it had skill, execution, pace, footwork. It was brilliant, and it was great to see.
And how clever was that try as well, the set piece try by France? I just, you know, I've looked at it about, you know, 20 times easily, and just everybody did their job so well. And I know you could say, yes, the England centre bit in a bit, and he did, but it was a great mixture between a complete training park move, so something that would have been drawn out by the coach, and using the smarts of getting our best player involved, which is something that we should look to do a lot. Actually, can we get DuPont into this and get him a touch in a different way? Yeah, they did. And then beautiful execution of the move and decision making within it as well. There was a number of key decisions that had to be made. It wasn't just this is what we're going to do and we'll score the try. There was crucial timing of pass and accuracy of pass that actually meant that the try was scored. So it was a thing of absolute beauty. I adored the game. It was phenomenal. I just wanted to keep on watching it. It was every element of it. I found charming and exactly what I wanted from rugby. But and I know we've been quite hard in Ireland, but there was a moment in the Ireland game we haven't spoken about, which was Tadhg Furlong's double step out of the 22, which immediately brought me back to my very early childhood watching 101 best tries, the Barbarians game, and Bennett having those two steps as in much easier circumstances where he had one defender running him, but it was like that. It was a step that you would have seen Bennett do, and it was absolutely phenomenal. So,
and it opened up the game. Actually, it wasn't just a step and then nothing happened. If CJ had picked the right option, it opened up the whole back line for Ireland.
Yeah,
and it's much more impressive as well, because Tadhg's the weight of about 2.5 Bennett's. Like, he was just shifting his hips like he was on the dance floor. Yeah. It was incredible. And again, that the wee moments like that, when we've got forwards with the ability like that, like Tadhg Byrne as well, made some big contributors. We just don't seem to build on it, and it doesn't seem to have the impact or bring the energy that a moment like that would to a French team or an English team.
Yeah, I think we've got, and again, I'm sorry, we're sort of regressing here and speaking about Ireland, but we have some players that are playing well, and I think have the ability to play even better and play a really effective type of rugby. So I think that's one of the reasons we're a little bit down on some of the back play, because in other areas, there's definitely progress.
Yeah, well, literally, I mean, Mike Catt said a few weeks ago where the game has changed is that it's much more unstructured attack now. There are lots of turnovers, lots of ball and play. So you can spend all your time doing all the lineouts you want, but you might only get six in an attacking position. Okay, Mike, let's try and score from one of them, like France did the other day, like that. Anyway, we're getting.
If our unstructured play was brilliant, I would say, okay, we don't need to worry so much about the set plays, Mike Catt. But our unstructured player is dire. It's actually probably worse than Italy's. We're probably the worst team in Europe at the moment for unstructured.
Is it good for the competition, though? Not just as a standalone, like that game was...
I'm really getting Simon's frustrations.
Yeah. I'm trying to find some sort of positive in which to kind of, head towards the end of the conversation. And that is that if France and England can move forward with the style of play that they're playing, that they played at the weekend, that's going to beat Ireland every time. And Ireland will actually have to adapt. And other teams, not just Ireland, Scotland, in fairness, Scotland do try to play with ambition anyway. You end up basically getting a much better competition, a much better sport, if everyone tries to play the way England and France have been.
I think so. And I think it's Ireland will have that reality brought home to them next week, because this England team are progressively getting better. And, if they play anything like the way that they played last weekend, they put a huge score on Ireland. But more than that, and maybe that's what Ireland need, and I just don't mean this Irish team, but I think structurally across the IRFU and what they think is important and necessary to evolve into a team that can now compete with England and France, because as they play like that, it would have to be, it would be, it's not impossible to beat them, because they can have a bad day. And when, I know we've sort of laboured the point on the TV, when we're talking about higher tariff play, when you're playing like that, the fall is higher when it doesn't go right. But generally, if they're playing anything like that, it becomes very, very difficult for Ireland to be with a more basic game plan. So when we were playing similar to that at the end of the Joe Schmidt reign, France weren't really the threat that they were. England actually probably weren't even the threat that they were. But we're in a different world now, where France and England look very strong, where Scotland are attempting to move their game on, and where Wales are, for all the weird year it has been, Wales tend to be able to deliver as a national team as well. So where does that leave Ireland? It leaves Ireland having to make fairly radical change to compete.
Andrew, I genuinely think the England-France game, if those two teams continue to play with that ambition, it'll actually be really good for Ireland, Scotland and Wales in the long term. I think in the short term, we're probably going to take a few beatings, but reality will hit home a lot quicker. Whereas there's so many years where England, France don't play to their potential, aren't well coached. Whereas I think both of them playing this well at the same time, and if those two keep playing each other to that level every year, we'll have that template there.
Yeah, I think hopefully that'll be the impact that it'll have on the rest of the Six Nations. Everybody say that's incredible. First of all, it's entertaining, but again, I don't think teams necessarily worry about entertaining people. They worry about getting wins. But if that's more likely to get you win, then hopefully teams start to follow that and start to take a few more risks. But then the issue is, if you end up with, and it's bizarre that we're talking about this, what I was going to say there was, if you end up with France and England and then everyone else, then you've got this kind of disconnect, and then you could end up like Scotland, Ireland, Wales, obviously Italy, all get hammered by the top two teams. If that's the way it goes, now we're totally getting carried away in one game. And it's bizarre that we're saying that whenever Wales have a chance of winning a Grand Slam. I think we know if France play the way they're going to play, that's not going to happen. We're all hopeful that's not going to happen anyway. But if you end up with that kind of disconnect, as in two tiers of quality in the Six Nations, I don't think that'll be good for the tournament either.
All right. Andrew, I know you're under a bit of time pressure, so if you have to leave before at the end of this final answer, it's no problem, because I'm asking Shane about boxing. Believe it or not, because the news came in that marvelous Marvin Hagler has died, age 66. Hagler was one of the greatest boxers of all time, one of the four kings of the middleweight boxing in the 1980s. And the reason I bring it up, Shane, is you actually met the man.
I did. I met him before the 2003 World Cup, and Eddie O'Sullivan brought in a number of different speakers. I don't know necessarily motivational, but it was. We had a long camp in advance of it, and it was. I think it was sort of to break up the weeks, and Marvin Hagler came into one, and it was about as surprising a special guest as we could have had. You know, I don't think anybody was thinking this was the man that was going to speak to us, but he was introduced by Jim Neely, who's of the Northern Irish boxing commentator, who had a relationship with I don't know, should I keep on calling him Marvelous Marvin? With Marvelous Marvin?
Oh, absolutely.
And so it was really it was such fun. He spoke really well. He addressed us. He answered questions for ages. I really enjoyed it, particularly because we would have grown up in quite a boxing household as well, so we would have been very aware of those four kings, those fights. And I have to say, I was always a Sugar Ray Leonard man, you know, and in that fight I was pulling for Sugar Ray Leonard. But having listened to him speak, and he was, by the way, he was so unhappy that with that result, he thought he was absolutely robbed, and Jim was leaning into that position as well. So by the end of it, we'd all written off Sugar Ray Leonard and realized that it should have been Marvelous Marvin. It was a kind of a surreal but a really amazing experience. So I was very sad to hear that he passed away. Very very young as well, because he was fit, he was healthy, he wasn't punchy at all, and he seemed like a good guy.
That was a hell of a speaker for Eddie to bring in that day, Shane. Sounds like a great memory. Brilliant stuff. Thank you so much, Andrew. Brilliant. Thank you.
Thanks
a
million.
Nice one. Thanks, fellas. Cheers.
Okay, I gave both fighters the instructions in the dressing room. I'm just cautioning you not. Obey my command at all times. Shake hands. Good luck to both of you.
The early rounds could really dictate how this fight will go. Shake it, unsteady pace. Hagler punishing Hearns now, but it is Hagler who is bleeding, and now Hearns bounces right back. This is still the first round. This may be the most brutal even round you've ever seen in boxing.
That's as good as it ever gets, folks. I doubt that there's ever been a better middleweight round than that one.
Trouble again. Hearns is down, and the third round, and on his back, and he's not going to beat the
Oh yeah, that's the audio bed from a show we did last May with Andy Lee, rewatching the iconic Hearns-Hagler fight from April 1985. It's episode 1759 if you fancy going back and having a listen. It's really amazing. It's a free-to-air one as well. We've also tweeted a link to it if you want to go back and have a listen in the wake of the news that we touched on there with Shane at the end of that chat. I don't know if you remember it, Murph. Andy was physically sweating his way through that fight. He was putting himself in the shoes of the Tommy Hearns, I think it was, and was really, really struggling to for the first couple of minutes of our chat.
He got engaged in the content to a quite extraordinary degree.
Murray Walker, the voice of Formula One, has also died. He was 97 years old. Two things always stand out when I think back to the 90s heyday. Well, certainly my heyday of watching Formula One. Murray Walker's voice and the theme tune of the BBC's coverage featuring Fleetwood Mac's The Chain. Ken, as our master of synth, I know this is not synth, but I don't know what you would describe, what genre you would describe Fleetwood Mac as, but are you a fan of this? Do you know this Formula One theme tune?
Everybody knows that theme tune, surely.
I would have thought so. I would have thought many do. I haven't heard your voice off podcast. I introduced you and we haven't heard from you since, so I just thought I'd...
What would you call...
Before we wrap things up, I thought I'd get you back involved.
What would you call Fleetwood Mac? Soft rock, I suppose.
We don't want a soft rock week, though, do we?
There's nothing wrong with soft rock, Owen.
No, there's yacht rock. Fleetwood Mac isn't yacht rock. We should definitely have a yacht rock week.
They're verging on it, but they're not yacht rock. But... Yeah. Look, it is another great genre. It's probably one that we should do a week on. But you know, I don't like the way you just try to just start these weeks off out of nothing. I mean, last week I expressed a liking for the Zane Greavesy theme tune, and before, like 5 minutes later, I'm something called the Master of Synth.
You are the Master of Synth.
So I'm just a little uneasy that you might be trying to railroad some similar thing.
No, it's, I think we need to give it a bit of space. Yeah, as resoundingly successful as Synth Week was, I think Soft Rock Week might have to never happen, or at least be a number of months removed.
Bank manager rock might be perilously close to my Spotify most played list, but I still don't think we should have a week dedicated to it.
For those of you looking for your football podcast today, we've got a short one already recorded and released. That one's available for everyone, but only our members will hear the full football podcast tomorrow after Liverpool play Wolves. And then again, later in the week after all the Champions League. You can sign up now on secondcaptains.com. Let's play out with a little bit of Murray Walker and Fleetwood Mac. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Murph.
Thank you, Owen. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Kieran. Thank you, Owen.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks for listening.
The 26 has started, and if Cross comes up to any of them, this is the opportunity that Senna's looking for, and he's going through. Senna is trying to go through on the inside, and it's happened immediately. This is amazing. Senna goes off at the first corner.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.